There's no ouzo talk without a bottle of ouzo, which is why we love the Greek Providor. Get a real taste of the very best produce that Greece has to offer. From olive oils and delicious artisan sweets, to unique spirits, earthy herbs and memorable wines. Visit thegreekprovador.com.au to see their amazing range. The Greek Providor, proud sponsors of the Ouzo Talk podcast. Craving something sweet? Head to Bay Vista Dessert Bar at Brighton Le Sands. Treat yourself to mouth-watering desserts, cakes, sweet and savory crepes, waffles, ice creams, and much, much more, all overlooking Sydney's iconic Brighton Beach. And now, also at Parramatta. Visit bayvista.com.au or drop on in for something sweet. Bay Vista Dessert Bar, proud sponsors of this episode of Ouzo Talk.
Sound is.
Kyrios Kakiri, welcome aboard Ouzo Talk episode 44. Today's flight will consist of a number of stops as we fly through the history of Greece's iconic national carrier, Olympic Airways. Your flight crew for today's journey are co-captains Nick Athanasiou and yours truly, Tom Skolarikas, as well as author of the book Olympic Airways, A History, Graham M. Simons. We're expecting relatively smooth flying today, with some turbulence expected during the flight and increasing towards the end of the journey. It's a story we know you'll enjoy hearing. So please, pour yourself an ouzo and ensure your seatbelt is fastened low and tight. Thank you for choosing the Ouzo Talk podcast. Oh, and please, no dancing in the aisles.
Oh, Nick, is smoking allowed on this flight? What do you reckon?
I reckon only smokers are allowed on the flight, mate.
We're harping back to a very important era in aviation, and particularly Greek aviation today, aren't we?
We are, definitely. It's a really exciting story, and I'm sure every Greek out there, or every Greek and non-Greek, has a story about this topic, don't they?
Definitely. I mean, let me ask you first. What's the first thing that comes to mind when you hear Olympic Airways?
Good question. Look, if you said to me in the 50s, 60s, 70s...
You were around then.
I would say I was. Yeah, 70s and 80s I was. Yeah. Look, it was a premium airline. Classy, premium, sophisticated. End of the 80s, 90s, 2000, I'd say a different view. It'd be more like the Munger airline, the cool airline, do whatever you want airline. That's how
it had a different reputation towards the end there. And, you know, it's an airline with a very interesting history. Some would say a turbulent history in aviation terms. But I got to say, for every Greek out there, as you said, everyone has a story to tell about either flying with Olympic Airways or seeing Olympic Airways somewhere. For me personally, I clearly remember flying Olympic as a kid from Athens and between islands to Corfu in particular, between Australia and Greece, obviously, aboard the 747, Olympic Peace, Olympic Spirit as well, I think it was, during that time, many of the 737s. And there was something special about seeing or boarding one of those 737s at Olynykon Airport there in Athens when you were driven out on the tarmac back in the good old days before the year 2000, before they went to Sparta. But it was just fantastic. I loved being on Olympic Airways all the way through. It was a taste of home, wasn't it?
You're right. There was something very unique about Olympic Airlines. And look, well said. I had a similar trip, but it was around 2000. But it was way after the Onassis era and so forth. But very memorable. And just I remember the staff clearly stood out for me. They were just confident. Definitely. The guy at the check-in counter looked like he just got back from the Bouzoukia. Had his cigarette in his mouth, his frappe. It was so unique.
This is the 80s, right?
This is probably a bit later. Yeah, 2000 exactly, on the dot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, 2000. It was a domestic flight, actually, from your neck of the woods, mate. Corfu to Athens. I'm pretty sure it was a turboprop, but I'm sure our guests will be able to tell us what it was. I thought it was a Dash 8, but not 100% sure. But yeah, very unique airline. And the staff just made it. You just couldn't happen to laugh or smile just with their attitude.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you something. You and I, as many people know, did work for Qantas at one stage. There is something to do with those two national airlines. So Qantas, in one respect, maybe not so much these days, but back in the day, wherever you were in the world when you would see that Qantas tail, you would think, okay, that's a piece of home. And there would be this element of pride. I can tell you, though, being in Sydney and seeing that Olympic tail land here at the airport, coming in over Botany Bay, that was something on a whole other level. Yeah. Because you knew that was a piece of Greece that had just landed.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And look, and you could tell from all the plane spotters as well. They're all there. They're all very proud and patriotic. I remember seeing that at one time in, I think it was the mid-80s, where initially they were clapping.
Yeah.
This is the plane spotters were clapping when it came in. Yeah. That's how patriotic they were.
On board and at Shep's Mound.
Correct.
Well, look, you did mention our guest, and we mentioned in that introduction who our guest is. Today, it's Graham M. Simons, the author. And let me tell you, to say that this man knows his aeroplanes and aviation history is an understatement. He's the author of over 60 books on aviation, among them the book Olympic Airways, A History. He's also one of the founders of the Aviation Museum at Duxford near Cambridge in the UK, where his interest in aviation was piqued when he watched the making of the amazing film Battle of Britain in the late 60s. It's one of my absolute favourites, Nick. If you haven't seen it, you've got to watch it. He's also a past member of the British Aviation Preservation Council to boot. More than anything, though, like Nick and I, he's a bit of an av geek and is someone who is absolutely fascinated by the story of Olympic Airways, having flown the airline and spent plenty of time in Greece himself, including quite recently. So, joining us live from the UK, Graham M. Simons, welcome to Ouzo Talk, mate.
Hi, I don't know whether I go good morning, good evening, good afternoon or what, but hi anyway.
It's one of those somewhere in the world. Well, look, we're really proud to have you, Graham. And look, you're not Greek, obviously, but you have a close connection, don't you?
Yeah, I've been going out to Greece since 1970. I went there for my honeymoon in 74. Last trip was 30 days around the Peloponnese a couple of months ago, where I managed to fall off a Greek castle. Never a dull moment when I go to Hellas.
For most people, I would say as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, as you were saying about seeing the tail land at Sydney, there's something special about Olympic Airways, just the same as I find there's something special about Hellas. By the time I land at Athena, within 2 minutes, I turn around and say to she who must be obeyed, otherwise known as the wife, we're home. And it just feels like that. It feels like home.
Wow. I agree with you. I think most people would agree with that, actually.
Yeah, definitely. Just before we get started, can you tell us how they say your name in Greece?
I am known as Graham Simons in Greece.
That is brilliant. Love it.
Fantastic. Well, Graham, it's absolutely fantastic to have you with us. Nick, what do you reckon? I think it's time that we take off, don't you?
I think so, mate.
Well, don't we, rather.
I'm strapped in. I've got my drink ready and ready to take off.
All right, let's do it. Stiniyamas Nick and Stiniyamas Graham, great to have you here. It's far too early for you to be drinking over there, obviously, Graham, but we are on the gins today. Well, cheers, mate. Cheers. There you
cheers,
go.
Graham.
Here's to you, Graham. Ooh, okay. All right, let me tell you. A lot of botanicals in that.
Yeah.
That's a strong one.
I actually really like that.
What is that?
Okay, so we're compliments of our amazing sponsors, the Greek Providor.
Mm.
It's called Stray Dog.
Stray Dog. Show the camera there. Show Graham what we've got there.
Very refreshing. It's a summer, I guess, summer of Greece. That's what it smells like.
And it's a Greek gin.
It is. Yeah. What can you taste in there? I've got a big checklist here.
Oh, well.
There's a lot of hope.
Don't think I've ever had Greek gin.
It's becoming a thing, isn't it?
It is, yeah, definitely. Look, there's a lot of small producers out there, and that's what Greek Providor are renowned for, going to the little small producers that produce quality products and export it all the way here to Australia for us. But look, this particular gin, yeah. it's got sage in it, it's got mastika in it, it's got orange, lemon.
I'm getting a bit of that citrus, actually, yeah. You're right.
And I was told to have it neat, not with anything else. And it's probably one of the best gins I've had.
I think so too.
Yeah.
I mean, the one that we had with Peter Menaeus from My Greek Odyssey was good, but it wasn't as strong as this.
No.
This one's got a real kick to it, Graham. We wish we could share one with you. No, I'm sure at some stage we'll get the opportunity to do so.
It's really good.
I'll stick with my low life fix. I'm quite happy with a glass of fix beer.
We're not knocking fix for 1 second. That's good stuff. But look, Graham, obviously you've told us a little bit about your connection to Greece, but what's your connection to Olympic Airways? Tell us a little bit about how you have been sort of connected with that story.
It goes back to when I first visited Corfu, actually, in 1970, back when the colonels were in power. Ouzo was 1.5 drachma a glass, and the glass kept getting more and more and more and more in the glass. We went out to Corfu on Britannia Airways back then with Britannia on one of their first 73s for a two-week holiday. And for the first 24 hours or so on Corfu, I just could not adapt. I couldn't get it. It was just, where on earth am I? What on earth is going on? I was still on London time and London pace, which is a very dangerous thing to be. And then all of a sudden, the whole Hellenic experience just fell into place. And I adored the country. I adored the island. I adored the people. It was wonderful. And when we went to go back to the UK, it was a midnight or 1 a.m. flight, I think, out of Kikira. And there was all the aircraft handling, all the hostesses, all the ground staff and all the rest were all Olympic people with just one Thomson Sky Tours rep. Everybody else was Olympic. That's when I experienced the full blast of the Olympic experience. Bit of a culture shock, yes. Like you said, you know, check-in staff, frozen frappe, cigarette, that was the staff. And she was pretty good looking as well, I've got to admit. And I just fell in love with the place. Next year, we got to go again. We got to go again. This time, we decided it was going to be not a charter flight, not a holiday flight. We would go for the full on OA experience. Boeing 720 out of Heathrow, straight into a Linicon. That was the full OA experience. We loved it. We had a brilliant time. The flight was interesting, as usual. and it was just something to savour, for lack of a better phrase. And year upon year upon year, we keep going back to Greece, different place, different island. If we were passing through Olynikon, I'd probably, because even back then I was an aircraft nut of the worst kind. And I'd go down to OA office and make out I was media, make out I was a journalist, and somebody had shoved me a load of press handouts and photos and all the rest. And if we had an ongoing flight, usually would stay at the hotel, the wonderful Hotel London out of Glyfada, which is right by the end of the runway there. And they used to run an all-night bar up on the roof for all us aviation enthusiasts, all the spotters. And nobody ever used to go to bed, sit up on the bar terrace there, Ouzo, bottle of Fix or whatever, and we'd be photographing the aircraft as they come in. And it just grew and grew and grew from there. I started doing a series of airline books here in the UK. By that stage, I was working for a UK airline, an airline called Danair, as their official historian. And the more I started doing the airline histories, the more people seemed to appreciate what I was doing. The staff of the airlines, Danair for a start, but other airlines later on, seemed to like my style because I didn't come out with the full public relations experience of we're the greatest thing since sliced bread, blah, blah, blah. I told the story as it was. I told some of the funnies. I told some of the behind-the-scenes in-jokes, experiences, and whatever. And the airline industry seemed to like what I was doing. The public, the travelling public, seemed to like what I was doing because I described it from the experience of a passenger and how it happened accordingly. And it just grew and grew and grew. Then one time I was with Pen and Sword talking to their commissioning editor and some of the people down there. you keep going to Greece, don't you? Yeah, of course I do, because they got used to me disappearing off of the UK scene for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. Oh, you can't contact him. He's in Greece again. The boss at Pen and Sword says, have you ever thought about doing the Olympic Airways story? I says, well, I've got loads of material. I just didn't think you guys would be interested in it because it's outside the UK sphere, for lack of a better phrase. Oh, no, we think it's worth it. We think it's worth doing. Get on with it. So, okay, fine, fair enough. Well, my method of research is not like everybody else's. Up there in the loft of this house, I converted the loft to a series of bins, for a lack of a better phrase. And I don't turn down anything aeronautical, especially airlines. If stuff comes my way, it gets used. I mean, you want some Olympic timetables?
Oh, wow.
I got plenty of Olympic timetables here, going right back to 1958.
Wow.
How good's that?
Checking stuff.
Wow.
Fantastic.
Oh, it gets worse. Useful information on your 707.
This is stuff that really should be in a museum.
720 menu card.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Early TAE stuff.
Unbelievable.
All of that is from one bin in my loft. My premise is that when that bin is full, that's when there's a book there.
Yeah, right. That's a very interesting way of writing.
It took about a year to write, and I think the safest way of saying it took 40 years of research, but it wasn't that I was researching all of the time. Researching, in terms of doing airline histories and stuff like that, it's not about going out and talking to people, although that is a part of it. The important part of it is gathering together all the information, sifting through it. When you've sifted through it, you start noticing there's a bit missing there. There's a bit missing there. Mm-hmm. Who can I talk to? Who can I get the information out of? And I started researching and I started talking. The FBI were most useful when it came to talking about wow. Aristotle Onassis.
Wow.
I managed to pull the FBI files on Aristotle Onassis, which is intriguing. There was a... It's getting a bit ahead of the story a little bit, but the demise, I think the demise of Olympic Airways in its classic form was the death of Alexandros Onassis,
yeah.
Aristotle Onassis' son. I managed to locate the original investigation into the crash, and that created a whole new scenario as to why what happened. It's just pulling all that stuff together
wow.
and putting it into, this is going to sound arrogant, I'm not trying to sound arrogant, it's putting it into a form that most people that can understand. I don't want to go super technical. It's way too easy to get very technical about the airline and the aircraft and all the rest. That's not what people want. They want to be able to understand it in layman's language, for lack of a better phrase.
Well, just based on what you've just said there, Graeme, it sounds to me like perhaps some of your research either opened some old wounds or some things that people maybe didn't want to sort of acknowledge or weren't prepared for. Is that a fair assessment?
There is a lot of, not deniability, but there is a lot of the whole story is almost confusing. People think OA from the Onassis days. Yes, Onassis bought the airline in 56, 57, but you've got to go back to 1919 for the start of it all. OA never started in 1919, but it had its roots and it's had its connections. From the original concept, from Winston Churchill, above all people, Winston Churchill decided that there was a need for air travel between the UK and the far reaches of the English or British Empire, which go out your way to Australia and New Zealand, go south to South Africa, including on that India. There was this need for the airline network. Mm. And given the range of the aircraft at the time, a crossroads in Europe was Athena. Flights could leave Croydon Airport in the UK, several stages to Athena. At Athena, they either turned right and went south to Crete and to South Africa. They went straight on to India, or they went slightly up over the top, not over the top of India, but Pakistan, that area, down to the Far East, Malaysia and whatever, and down through Darwin, Alice Springs, sort of, down to Melbourne and Sydney. That crossroad started to take shape from about 1930 onwards. The Greek populace, and I'll include in on that the politicians and all the rest, there was no need to expand a vast amount of money because Imperial Airways in Britain were doing it, Air France from France were doing it, KLM Royal Dutch Airlines were doing it to serve their empire territories, for lack of a better phrase. Athens actually found itself, and Greece in fact found itself, at this crossroads of Europe that was well served by other airlines. There was no need for it. There was a creation from the 1930s onwards that involved some of the Italian airlines flying mainly initially into Corfu, Agrigento, Athena, Thessaloniki, out via Lesvos in one direction, Mytilene, serving Constantinople and the likes going that way, going south, Hardia, via Crete from either land planes or seaplanes. There was almost this denial that we need do it because everybody else is serving us. Why spend the money, you know? That maintained itself right through to the start of World War II. Things got put on hold for the period of the Second World War. And after the Second World War, I have to look up the guy's name, Stefanos Zotos, who was a former Royal Hellenic Navy officer who was transferred across to the Air Force, the Hellenic Air Force in 25. He formed a company called Technical and Aeronautical Exploitations SAE, otherwise known as TAE, which everybody
very catchy
immediately adopted it. TAE started operating out of Tatoy, and from that point onwards, it was operating mainly around Europe with Douglas DC-3 Dakotas. There was another airline called Hellenic Air Services, which had a tie-in with Scottish Aviation here in the UK. They were flying converted B-24 Liberator bombers as passenger aircraft. It was generating a Hellenic aviation content and context, but it was still very, very low key. It was receiving a certain amount of state funding. It was receiving a certain amount of state support, although it was primarily a private organization. Into that came Aristotle Onassis, with all of his Wheeler dealings, with all of his charm and style, because if anyone brought anything to the airline, it has to have been Aristotle Onassis. I mean, at one stage he was putting gold-plated cutlery in first class. It was that started the whole positive Olympic experience. And of course, at virtually the same time as Onassis took over TAE and created Olympic Airways, it was the start of jet air transport. The jet airliners were the Comet. That created the jet set. And you only have to look at how things were portrayed at Alinicon, for example. It was a place to go to see and be seen. And things changed totally differently from that point onwards.
Mm.
Aristotle announces word his son Alexandros to be groomed to take over the empire, which is a very traditional Greek thing of the son superseding the father to continue the dynasty. Yeah, the legacy and all that. I mean, it's all very traditional. Alexandros was given Olympic Aviation, which was the domestic side of Olympic Airways International, to run it. And he did a very good job of creating a domestic air service. He did a very good job pioneering Olympic helicopters, both in terms of landing or ferrying people to some of the smaller islands that didn't have airports as such to land on, and also did a lot of, I won't say air sea rescue, but medevac flights, for, getting people off of the islands for medical treatment, for urgent medical treatment. And he did a remarkable job of doing that. But unfortunately, he was lost in an accident to one of Anastasia's Piaggios, a little piston seaplane. His death caused an upset, for lack of a better phrase. Aristotle and Onassis just couldn't handle the death of his son, and understandably so. And that tipped him over the edge into a paranoia. That was the denial aspect of it. I sense now, look, a question.
We're going to get into more detail and all that. Look, can I just take it right to the beginning? When Aristotle took over, were they the premium airline at that time compared to the rest of the world?
No, they wasn't. They was one of a myriad of other regional airlines. And I say regional airlines not in the context of how we see regional airlines today. OA was regarded as a national flag carrier, just as Imperial Airways carried a Union Jack on the aircraft. That was the flag carrier for the United Kingdom, just as Air France carried the tricolour for France. TAE and OA were flag carriers for Greece. They were regarded as representative of Hellas, but they were nothing special. They were just one more airline that served a particular region. In the context of OA, it was predominantly around the Eastern Mediterranean, with spurs out to Paris and London, because again of the connections there. In the early days, they were making flights to the USA, not themselves, but they had a code-sharing ticketing arrangement that they would transfer passengers from an OA service at a hub to a TWA service for onward flights to the USA. So there was an international aspect, but in the early stages, they were definitely just a local airline, standard dress, typical airline from the male point of view, whether we're talking about flight crew or whether we're talking about stewards. It was almost a nautical appearance, but there again, that's understandable considering you look at what Onassis's background was. He was a very strong nautical guy, so it was understandable that he picked up on the nautical theme, the dark blue uniforms, the gold brocade, or the gold epaulettes and stuff like that.
I did read that the crew were wearing Coco Chanel and Pierre Cardin. I think Coco Chanel was the first one. And then,
oh, yeah, but that's a latter stage. Initially, the air hostesses, all right, trolley dollies. The air hostesses, they were dressed in quite severe 1950s style uniforms, quite tight fitting, sensible hats, white gloves and handbags. That was the style back then. I'm talking about the 1950s now.
Cool.
It was classic elegance of the time. In the 1960s, things evolved, things changed. not all of a sudden. Anassis decided he wanted to go with the jet set image. If you're going to go with a jet set image, you've got to have style, class, elegance. You've got to have nice interiors. You've got to have your staff dressed appropriately. At one stage, they were going down the road of Coco Chanel uniforms, which is one of the first occasions of an airline approaching a couture designer to come up with a uniform for the hostesses that was very Paris chic, for lack of a better phrase. They went from Chanel, there was a whole range of other designers. He used a couple of Hellenic fashion designers and went to great lengths marketing the style and the uniform. Yes, at one stage, because it was the 1960s, it was cloche hats, it was mini skirts. But again, it was this high-end haute couture fashion that was so different. And that was one of the things that made the airline stand out.
We've heard stories that Onassis made a point, for example, of when his crew was, I think it was in Paris or in New York or wherever they were, he would make sure to book them a table at an expensive hotel or restaurant or something for the crews to actually go there to be seen as part of the marketing for the airline. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. That's very correct. I mean, equally, when OA opened their office in Fifth Avenue, it was done with style and panache, but it was done with this hard, hidden edge, if that makes sense, to get the media to pick it up and report it. He would make sure that crews night stopping in New York or wherever, yes, they book into a high-end restaurant, but he'd also make sure they turned up in their uniforms because the uniform was identifiable with OA. Hey, look at that. The crews are eating in this restaurant. It all raised the image of the airline. I mean, when he opened Fifth Avenue, it was all done with great style and panache. But he had two hostesses dressed in traditional outfits as a uniform. It was like they were dressed in 19th century clothes. These two girls were dressed in 19th century clothes. And I was so puzzled by this one photograph. This is what I mean about
it's a marketing stuff
the style
up.
Of the uniforms.
It sounds like he handpicked the flight attendants because they seem to be all pretty.
I got to be honest, no, that's not the case. It was a requirement that the cabin staff had to be to a certain style and standard. Recruitment made sure the girls were a certain height. Recruitment made sure that the hair was a certain length. I found the photo. That's the opening.
Yeah, right.
The London of the New York office with the girls in the uniform.
It's a bit of a mismatch, isn't it?
Yeah, it doesn't work for an airline. Then I went to Kalamata to the Museum of Traditional Dress. Lo and behold, that's the closest I found. It's very traditional. He was marketing the airline on Hellenic tradition. He was trying to prove and to market the pride in Hellas going way back. That was one ploy that got him a lot of publicity. The other ploy was turning the girls out. The head air hostess, the head of cabin staff at the time, virtually inspected the girls before a flight. They had to be turned out just so. And again, it works because all of a sudden you recognize who the airline is just by looking at the girls as they walk through the airport, looking at the girls on the check-in desk. You have ground crew dressed in bright yellow uniforms. Once you know that the airline has bright yellow uniforms, you don't have to look at the signs above the check-in desk. You see the yellow staff there. That's it. That's Olympic. That's where I got to go. It's almost subliminal advertising, but it works so well.
Well, he did a fantastic job of it, didn't he? I mean, at the end of the day, it's almost a bit of a masterstroke from him. It sounds like so much of what we associate with that particular period of Olympic and what was successful about it came down to the personal taste of Onassis, really.
Yeah, Onassis had style. Whatever you thought about him, whatever you thought about his personal battles with Stavros Nikarios, whatever you thought about his womenizing with goodness knows how many women, the guy had style and the guy had taste. He'd also got the money to back it up. And frankly, he wasn't afraid to spend it to come up with that right sort of image.
Mm.
Sometimes it almost turned around and bit him in the ass in the sense that, yeah, okay, in the introduction to this, you made mention about the smoking, no smoking. There was no such thing as a no smoking flight or a no smoking area on Olympic Airways. Everybody smoked everywhere. It's just how it was. I've had some flights from Heathrow to Athena. There was a virtual party going on the entire damn aircraft because that's how it was. You'd have a 7-0 flight come into Heathrow from the USA, sit on the ground for an hour or so, pick up the London passengers and go on to Athena. The occupants of the flight coming in had had 8 hours of partying before they got to Heathrow. I won't say it was encouraged, but it was tolerated.
Well, let's talk about that, because the commercials that were put out during that time allude to the fact, and we heard it in the intro as well, no dancing in the aisles. Obviously, that came from somewhere. What were they doing on board during those times?
Okay, I make no secret, I'm no Greek, but I've been out there enough times. Get on a local bus sometimes. You go to a village up in the mountains. Go into the town square and that village is so proud that they have a bus service. There's a huge board in the square giving the timetables, giving the route of the bus. Now, the fact that the bus may not stick to that route because the bus driver's delivering half a dozen chickens to his brother who's 5K down the road, that's got nothing to do with it. But that's Hellas, right? Or the old style, alas. And you've got a similar thing. Get on that local bus. Everybody's talking to each other. Everybody's sharing the stories about how their cousin twice removed daughter's had a baby. And, you know, you're sitting next door to a Greek priest in his stovepipe hat. And that's how it was. That progressed from the local bus service to the local airline service. Right. I've been down at Alinicon on the domestic side before now. None of us are allowed to board until the local priest has got on board the aircraft and blessed it. That's how it is, how it was. And you had the same thing on the international service. Put 20 or 30 Greeks in an enclosed space where they're serving alcohol, what are you going to get? You're going to get a party. You get a Greek party, what are you going to get? You're going to get dancing. Where's the only place you can dance on an aircraft? Dance in the aisles. There's the roots of that story.
That's unbelievable.
Classic.
So it was rooted in truth, Nick. No dancing in the aisles.
Definitely.
Prove me wrong.
Yeah. Wow. Have you got any other fascinating stories what went on in the aircraft?
There's one story, archetypal maybe. I don't know how true it is. I don't even know whether it is about OA, but it's one story that I heard. There was this wonderful old lady sitting in first class, being a complete pain. And she was complaining about everything. Nothing was right. The food wasn't right. It was hot, too hot. It was too cold. Eventually, just before she landed at Athena, or the aircraft landed at Athena, I've got a terribly sore throat. It's the air conditioning of this aircraft. It's terrible. It's dried out my throat. I've got a terribly sore throat. Get me something for this sore throat. So the chief steward went back to the rear galley, comes back forward, silver salver tray, which again, OA had either silver or gold trays. All of the cabin service stuff was done on gold trays with a beautifully white damask napkin over it. straight to the front of the aircraft, in front of the lady, and with a glorious flourish went down. At the same time as he went down, he took the napkin off, revealing a carving knife. Something for your throat, madame.
Wow. That's not where I thought it was going.
Carving knife, pray. Something for your throat.
Classy.
That's brilliant.
How do you come back after that?
Oh, dear. There's stories like that. This is one of the reasons why I love doing the airline histories. And it's not just OA. There's so many wonderful background stories that don't normally get told. But equally, there's other stories that does involve stuff. I mean, just before OA moved out of Alinikan across to Venizelos, there were putting Olympic domestic flights out of Alinikon using little Dorniers, 18-seat Dornier turboprops. The Hellenic government had just opened up a new airport on Kythera. Now, Kythera is not exactly a well-known island. It's not exactly a popular island. Into Alinikon on, I think it was an OA Airbus back then, it might have been a 7-2. I'd need to look it up. But we got this domestic flight. We left Alinikon out over the Aegean, 2,500 feet, low-level sightseeing. There was no cabin staff on board, not on board an 18-seat Dornier, just the captain leaned round through the doorway and went like that, saying, make sure your seatbelt's done up. That was the entire safety briefing. If ever you've been to Kythera, you'll know that the airport is on quite a high plateau. We didn't land at Kythera. The ground rose up to meet us. Literally, wow. No descent, no nothing. The ground went up to meet us. It was just developed as a new airport, massive, massive airport. Loads of European money went into it, European flags everywhere. They'd just built a new terminal, but the terminal wasn't open. In fact, the airport was only open for half an hour a day to handle one flight a day.
Right.
The flight I was on. No baggage reclaim, no nothing. Just an Olympic Airways trolley. You smashed your own bags. You claimed your own bags from the trolley that the ground handling guy had thrown them onto. Oh, well, here we go. Greece again.
I can sort of one-up that story in some way. This was 1989. I barely remember this story, but my mum tells the story, but I can kind of remember it. I was only a few years old. At Alinikon Airport, we'd just boarded a 737, and there was no crew on board. So we got driven out to the aircraft, sitting on the tarmac for about an hour. Everyone's just sitting there thinking, okay, what's going on? There's no cabin crew, there's no pilot, there's nothing. We're just sitting on this 737 in the heat. Probably about 45 minutes into the wait, this guy comes onto the aircraft, shaved head completely, knee-high Doc Marten boots, leather jacket, and he starts looking around the cabin. And he comes to my mum, who had me as a young child there, and says, oh, ma'am, do you mind if I put your bag up into the overhead locker? And she said, no, I'm okay. I want to hold it. and she's looking around going, what's going on here? My dad wasn't sitting with us. He was right at the back of the aircraft. He's watching this quizzically going, who's this bloke? He goes and proceeds to walk into the cockpit and shuts the door and starts winding up the engines. And he flew us by himself to Corfu that morning with no co-pilot and with no staff on board. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened all the time, but it did happen on that flight.
Yeah. Wow, what a story.
I'm not sure if that contravenes any IATA rules.
Probably. Did you ever fly on the Nihongs, the YS-11s?
No, I didn't. Nick?
No.
The YS-11s were Olympics domestic service in the early 70s right through to probably about 1980. They were twin-engine turboprops bought from Japan. Really nice aircraft, comfortable, fairly fast, solid as a rock. My first YS-11 experience was into Santorini. Back in the days when Santorini was worth going to. I'm not going to go down there. Why I don't think it is worth going to right now. But this is back in the days when Santorini was nice, and it was on the hippie trail. And you had a choice of getting a YS-11 flight out of Ellinikon to Santorini, or a 16-hour Actian ferry service out of Piraeus. I chose the YS-11. Well, it was a standard YS-11 flight, about 10, 12,000 feet, until you got over one of the islands where they let down over the island, over the NDB, a non-directional beacon, over this particular island to 500 feet to go across the Ionian Sea to Santorini. Basically, what they were doing was 5,000 feet aiming at a cliff face, because there was no radio age back then on Santorini. And when you got within about a mile of this cliff, you did a 180 degrees and landed. It was an interesting experience. But the worst thing about it was the YS-11 itself. They were Japanese-built aircraft, and I'm not being racist in the slightest, but if you've ever met a Japanese, they're not very tall, right? Compared to Europeans or Australians, they're fairly short as a race, as a nation. The windows were down here, and if you had to look out, you were looking like that. You had to virtually stoop down to look out the windows, because if we looked out, you looked straight at the cabin wall. It was hilarious. But again, OA had a very mixed fleet. They had 747s for the long haul, going to the US, going to Australia. You had a very luxurious 747. For medium haul, you had the 72s or the 73s. If you're doing inter-island stuff, it was everything from Britain, Normand Island to Alouette helicopters, to the little Dorniers, to the modern-day Dash 8s. There was a whole range of aircraft sizes that fitted the service that they was used on. And the only other airline I've ever come across that had that sort of flexibility and adaptability was Danair. We had this whole different range of aircraft that fitted the services we want. And OA had the same. And it worked incredibly well.
Obviously, that's a point of difference and a very unique part of what Olympic was. I'm guessing that may have played some sort of role in, you know, inefficiencies in terms of having so many aircraft types and having to have parts for all of those aircraft types and having to train people on all of these things as well.
It was a double-edged sword. It worked remarkably well that you could have a social network, inter-island service, islands across to the mainland. Every small community had air travel links to the mainland, to the capitals. That provided an incredibly worthwhile social service, in the sense that if people had to go to Athena on an emergency, medical emergency or whatever, there was air travel there available to them. Everywhere in Greece was linkable to Athena within an hour and a half. Nowhere was more than an hour and a half away from the central population. And it was wonderful that sort of facility was available. I nearly made use of it one time. We were going to Skopelos, got to Skopelos, 2 days into Skopelos. Guess who developed a tooth abscess? Not a fun experience when you're stuck on a Greek island and the nearest dentist is in Athens, because the local dentist had gone on holiday. Quick flight to Athena, taxi trip out to the Gifada, where there was a dentist. Some of the strongest antibiotics you've ever had in your life. I wish I'd have known about them earlier. It was good stuff. I was on enough antibiotics in Tranks that would have flattened a horse, but nah, go to Athens, see the dentist, get taken care of. The downside of this whole social airline domestic service thing was exactly as you say. The airline technical staff had to be trained to cover this whole range of aircraft, and they had to hold quite a large holding of spares to keep them serviced. It wasn't as bad as a lot of people seem to think, because what was happening, they'd hold spares for immediate use, but they had direct connections and an air freight to all of the aircraft manufacturers, that if something went wrong with, I don't know, 727, 737, whatever, they'd get it air freighted from Seattle or from wherever, the local hub. I mean, Boeing had a huge hub for aircraft spares in France that they could call on. So it was never as bad as a lot of people thought, but it could be problematic at times, let's put it that way.
So it sounds like there's a lot of expense going on with different types of aircraft and parts and so forth. Was it a profitable airline when Onassis was involved?
When Onassis was involved, it was very profitable. He had a lot of initial expenses. He was probably spending more money than was advisable. If the bean counters were listened to, he was spending far too much money than he needed to provide the service. But again, this goes back to Onassis and his sense of style and all the rest. He was prepared to spend the money to give the girls Pierre Cardin uniforms and stuff like that. It could have been made more efficient. It could have been made more profitable. Of course it could. But his whole idea was, it's my airline, I run it as I want. When he married Jackie Kennedy, he was using the aircraft to ferry people in from the US to fly them to Scorpios. They were his own personal taxi service. Now, that's not efficient, but hey, 10 out of 10 for style. and that was part and parcel of it. Overall, the bottom line on the account sheet could have been better, yes, but it still stayed the right side of the line.
Yeah. Wow. Great question, though, Nick. Great question.
Thanks, mate. Look, another thing that you just touched on earlier on at the beginning of the episode, part of your research was to contact the FBI and do some research on Onassis. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
And what did you find?
Tell us some good stuff that you heard from the FBI about Onassis. And were they forthcoming as well?
Yeah, FBI sent a whole bunch of files over that I've ended up putting into five separate files. They were monitoring him 24/7, 365. Although, to be honest, they never found anything worthwhile of prosecution. They were concerned about him from the point of view of some of his contacts, some of the people he dealt with. But the man was an entrepreneur. He was a businessman. And back then, it was you dealt with whoever you had to deal with to make any money. He was unscrupulous. There's no two ways about that. But that's just how it was.
Was any of their concern to do with the fact that he had married, I'm guessing that would be the case, that it was the fact that he had married the wife of a former US president? Was there concern that there was some kind of compromise there?
Yes and no. That he was investigated because of his connections over Jackie Kennedy, but he'd been investigated for many, many years before that with his oil tankers, with his battles with Stavros Nikarios, with his connections with Standard Oil and some of the American oil companies, with some of the dealings he did with the Saudis. It's a huge involved story that's probably worth two or three podcasts on their own. And I'm not expert enough to deal with that sort of thing. But he was investigated, and his connections from OA across to TWA, because there was a certain amount of code sharing and stuff like that that went on. It was typical J. Edgar Hoover and American paranoia.
Wow. Also, around that time, you mentioned that Alexander, his son, passed away in a some people say was an accident, some people say it was deliberate. It was conspired by the CIA, FBI. Can you add any context to that, and what's your view on it?
I started looking at that story when I came across it. It was serious and important enough that it warranted a separate chapter in the OA book, simply because the whole episode had tremendous implications for the future of OA. Aristotle Onassis was convinced that it was a conspiracy theory, that it involved an assassination squad. it was all pretty strange. What actually happened was the Anassis family hired a new, what today would be called a corporate pilot, to fly their Piaggio amphibians. They owned a couple of Italian-built twin-engined amphibians that they used to fly from wherever to his private yacht, the Christina, to get people across to it. Alexandros wanted to change it from a seaplane service, which was not actually inherently safe because there was problems with hitting obstacles in the water and all the rest. He would, Alexandros wanted to use helicopters to ferry passengers across. But no, Aristotle Anassis insisted on maintaining the seaplanes because he liked the style and the panache that it gave him. It looked good to fly into an amphibian, fly in with an amphibian to Nice or Monaco, where he had casino interest, for example. So they hired a new pilot for the seaplanes, and it was Alexandros' job to check out this new guy to fly the aircraft. And it was all planned and scheduled that they would do a flight out of Ellinikon, around the Gulf, do a few practice water landings, and then back to Ellinikon as a checkout flight. They got onto the aircraft, they started the amphibian up, they taxied out to the runway, and they waited for an Air France 727 to get airborne. There was a Air France 72 in front of them. They taxied out the runway, they took off. No sooner as they got airborne, the aircraft effectively flipped over onto its back and dived nose in, landing about halfway down, just to one side of the runway at Ellinikon, about halfway down the length of it. The pilot was a survivor. The observer on board was seriously injured, but survived, if memory serves me correct. But Alexandros was severely injured. He was taken to a medical facility, where eventually, after Aristotle Anassis was called in, they switched off the life support. Anassis was convinced it was a conspiracy plot, it was assassination, it was his rivals trying to do away with the dynasty and all of the rest. The more I looked at it, the more I was convinced it was not and could not be an assassination attempt. Anassis put blame on to a couple of the engineers, but how could the engineers cause the aircraft to crash? The theory was that the control cables were somehow deliberately crossed. This is from the pilot's control wheel to the waggly bits on the wings and the waggly bits at the back. Somehow were crossed, so they thought they were pulling it up. And if it was crossed, they was actually pulling it up and it would go down, or they was turning to the left, it was actually turning to the right. When I eventually got hold of the actual investigations report, and when I got hold of the Piaggio's aircraft manuals, it was clear that it would have been very, very difficult to have crossed those controls. It had probably taken 6 hours to have crossed the control, to physically get into the aircraft, open up all the panels, cross the controls, then put everything back again. How the hell are you going to do that on something like the apron at Ellinikon? It's just not possible. You'd be spotted. You'd be noticed. Then I started looking at other things. And one of the reports that came out from NASA, believe it or not, in the USA, NASA did a study on what was called wake turbulence. That's the disturbed air behind an aircraft. And funnily enough, they did all these tests using a 727. And they discovered that the disturbed air behind an aircraft after takeoff lasted much longer than was first expected. When I looked at the flight logs from Ellinikon and all of the rest, there was a very short period between the Air France taking off and the Piaggio following behind him. This wake turbulence creates a vortex spinning air that I think the Piaggio got caught up in. It got caught up in and it literally did that and went in. I think it was just an accident through lack of knowledge. Like a lot of air crashes, air safety progresses after an accident because you learn from it. You learn Hopefully. What you didn't. I know this sounds silly, but you learn from what you didn't know. They weren't aware of how bad wake turbulence was. So this crash that effectively killed Alexandros, they learned from, and that's why the spacings was increased. Until still to this day, you have to allow a certain amount of time between an aircraft taking off and another one that follows it. Again, if you listen to aircraft radios, you'll hear large aircraft go 1-2-3 heavy, and they put heavy on the message to let people know it's a big aircraft, therefore there's more wake turbulence, therefore space it out. That's why you get a huge gap after the takeoff of an A380.
Yeah, true, makes sense.
Sorry if I got boring, but there you go.
No, that's interesting, fascinating stuff.
So that's debunked.
So are you saying that the wires had nothing to do with it and it was the turbulence?
The
wake turbulence.
My opinion, there's no evidence that the wires were crossed. It's a supposition, just the same as my explanation. It's not an explanation. My theory, for lack of a better phrase, is no more than a supposition, the same that the conspiracy theory of sabotage is anything more than a supposition. My view is it was an accident. The conspiracy theory is acceptable when one looks at the very masculine Greek mentality of ensuring the dynasty, like we said before. An older Greek man's son is the apple in his eye. He can't do anything wrong, and he's there to continue the lineage. There's the pride in the son. It's almost natural to think in terms of a conspiracy, someone is out to do this to me. But whether that's an actual reason or not is a different matter. I personally subscribe to the wake turbulence theory.
Mm. Yeah. Well, in a similar sort of vein, obviously there have been a few accidents when it comes to Olympic aircraft. And one of the most prominent ones that's spoken about is the incident in 1978 with Flight 411. People have labeled it terror over Athens and, the 747 not being able to climb further than a few hundred feet. A lot was made in the last few years, actually, since it's become even more prominent, the fact that there wasn't really a formal investigation into it, bringing into question how reliable were a lot of the accounts when it comes to looking into that accident. I'm just wondering, did you find a similar situation when it came to looking at that particular crash with Onassis' son?
Air crashes, air incidents, call them what you will, there is never one event that causes it.
Mm.
It is always a series of events.
The Swiss cheese effect, as they say.
Yeah. If the Mercedes that Alexandros rode out to Olynikon in needed fuel, and they'd stopped at a gas station to fill up when they left Syntagma, that Mercedes would have arrived at Olynikon 5 minutes later, by which time the Air France had taken off, no wake turbulence. It's a whole series of circumstances that have to come together just at that point in time. If it was there, it wouldn't happen. You've got the same thing with the 7-4 over Athens. You've got the same thing with the YS-11 that crashed near Glyfada. If the timing had been slightly different, they wouldn't have happened. You've got the same thing in this. An investigation will only tell you so much. Sometimes the answer is never there. It's never there to be found. You can look for little tiny paint chips. If that paint chip is washed off, there's no cause there because you can't see it because it landed in the sea.
Mm.
That paint chip could have blocked a fuel line, da-da-da-da-da-da. There's no easy answer. Mm. Air crash investigation makes a wonderful title for a TV series, but it's not as easy as they make out for a 58-minute TV program.
Yeah.
Sorry if it sounds like I'm avoiding the question, but it's just way too complex to come up with a simple soundbite.
Let's talk briefly about that Flight 411 then. That comes, a few years after the crash that we just spoke about. What do you know about that actual flight? For those who don't know, the story in a nutshell is basically that a 747 takes off from Ellinikon Airport there in Athens and basically struggles to gain any altitude and is at very high risk of falling right in the center of Athens. By all accounts, and by, you know, and maybe this is the Greek pride shining through, but any Greek that knows the story says that Captain Sifis Migadis is a hero, and it was an amazing piece of aviating from him. How have you seen it?
Well, it was definitely a brown trouser job.
Certainly that.
It was certainly that. I don't think, from what I've seen and read of it, I don't think anybody has actually came up with, this is exactly what happened. This is what actually caused it. The 7-4 was down on power. They got airborne. There was not enough power to climb. Early 7-4s had a habit of being down on power at various stages. They had a hell of a problem in the early days of actually losing engines. So you ended up with a three-engined airliner, the size of a 747. It's not exactly an interesting experience. You can have meteorological problems, temperature inversions and things like that that can cause problems with aircraft flying. You can have incorrect control settings. You know, the captain speaking decided he's going to pull the flaps up too early, or he ordered his slave, otherwise known as the first officer, to retract the flaps because they were going out, basically flying out to the west over the city. They're following noise abatement procedures, which means pull back on the power from a certain altitude until you reach a certain altitude, so it's not quite as noisy. I don't think it has ever been fully determined exactly what went wrong. What did go wrong was the aircraft was down on power, and that was then at the stage where we got to do something. Well, the first thing was come out with spectacles, testicles, wallet and watch, cradling. Hell, let's get out of this situation. And that's what he did. He stopped deliberately flying and went on to his own personal autopilot. He handled that aircraft instinctively. He knew he had to get away from the city and he had to get whatever altitude he could to go round and sort out the problem.
Well, at one stage, he was actually aiming for the hill with the intention of crashing it there.
Yeah, but it was all instinctive. This is my plan. If I crash on the hill, I'm not crashing on the city. If you crash on the hill, you're not on a centre of population. You're only going to wipe out 400 people on the aircraft. Sorry, it sounds overly dramatic, but it's true.
Yeah.
There was an incident of this only a couple of weeks ago where a Delta Airlines flight had a major engine failure out of Prague Airport. The first thing he did was fly straight ahead, get whatever altitude he could, sort out the problem, go around and land. That's what he did. And this is effectively what happened with this one. Be as safe as you can in the context that you're not harming people on the ground. If we limit the damage to us on board, well, tough, it's sad, can't take a joke, shouldn't have joined. At least we're minimising any danger. As it was, he did everything right. You got to admit it, it's the training kicking in. It's the years of experience kicking in. But it's instinctive. You haven't got time. I've interviewed a couple of pilots who have been in that situation, and they have said they don't have time to think. They just do it.
Yeah,
It's like if you're unfortunate to have a motorcycle crash. You don't think what you're doing, you just do it.
Yeah,
and definitely. It's the circumstances there.
So what I read, Sifis was a fighter pilot before he became a commercial pilot.
Well, they all had to be. It was a requirement.
And my understanding was when he took off, they knew they were dead. They said, there's no way we can keep this up. Even there's another report that I read where the cabin crew at the end of the aircraft, the back of the aircraft, saw engine 3 explode and left fragments of the engine all through the runway, and she phoned the purser, and they basically said, we're done, we're gone, in those terms. What I wanted to say was the textbook definition of what to do with this was to leave the wheels down, leave the landing gear down. But for him, he actually lifted the gears up to create more speed, to create less friction. So he actually went against what
Boeing... Less drag.
Less drag. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that, why he did that, and what were the other circumstances that kept this plane up? Because from what I read, this plane should have crashed. And they did try this in the Boeing simulator several times. They could never get this plane up in the air. Every time they tried this exact same scenario in the simulator, it crashed.
The Boeing really doubted the data when they were told. They said, no, that it didn't happen like that. Your instruments were wrong.
I was once on Santorini walking around one of the mountainsides, and I swear where I was, you could have met one of the Greek gods coming round the corner. I'm not religious. But there was this sense that the old gods are out there looking after you, watching you. When you got something the size of a 747 and the undercarriage is down, that causes a tremendous disruption to the air under the aircraft, and the air passing the undercarriage as it's dangling down, dangling the Dunlops as it's called in the trade, can slow the aircraft down a lot. The book says, keep the undercarriage down because you can land it. Captain speaking decided, nah, instinct says I want to get me airspeed. I want to keep myself flying as much as I can. He pulled the gear up. Pulling the gear up reduced the drag, the resistance of the air on the aircraft. It gave him probably 20, 25 extra knots. That extra speed he got by retracting the undercarriage and talking to Zeus and a few of the old gods up there kept the aircraft in the air. Again, a theory. It's speculation. But things like that happen. I've known it with other pilots where they've had an aircraft and they have said something was out there helping me.
Definitely. From what I read, the minimum airspeed was 180 for that particular aircraft, 747-200. They hit 150.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the weight and everything else, but yeah.
Yeah, so it was a fully loaded, it was going to New York, I believe, fully loaded aircraft, 400 passengers, yeah. I think it was 18 crew on board as well. And is it true they cleared the hill by 9 feet, which is like 3 meters?
I don't know the exact fit, but... Yeah.
The common expression is that they were scraping antennas off the buildings.
Yeah, definitely. So. And there was a stage where they were flying and they could see the people in the buildings at eye level because they were... virtually parallel to some of these buildings. Well,
one thing's for sure about this. I mean, you talk about famous captains. I mean, we were talking about this the other day. You talk about famous pilots like, you know, Sully,
Sullenberger, Hudson.
Miracle on the Hudson, Captain Richard de Crepigny from Qantas, the QF-32. This is another one of those. The interesting thing is that those ones can be explained pretty well because of the level of oversight there is nowadays. This one sort of is a little bit different in that it's a little bit further back.
Definitely. Yeah, look, there are a couple of reports. Again, it depends what you read. One report I read was the water pumps weren't switched on. Therefore, the third engine blew up because it overheated. And we're talking, what was the date on this? August
78. 8.
Was it in August? As we know, in August in Athens, how hot does it
9th
get?
9th of August.
So it's probably around 40-odd degrees on 9th of August. So these water pumps weren't on. Boeing said they weren't switched on, but other pilot experts said it's impossible to see that they weren't switched on because in front of the console, apparently you see four lights to see that the water pumps are on to cool the engines down. That's where the discrepancy is. Boeing was saying, no, he didn't turn the water pumps on, but the crew and, or in particular, the engineer believed that it was impossible not to miss it, especially with the expert pilot they had in there who virtually saved the day, which would have been, I think, the third worst airline accident in the world if it did go down.
It's an accident that should have happened but didn't. Like I was saying about how timing comes in, if Alexandros's Mercedes needed petrol and they'd stopped at a gas station, they wouldn't have been close to the accident with the Air France thing. This is another set of circumstances where if anything else had happened, it had gone in.
Yeah.
Something out there was watching them. You talk to a lot of pilots and they'll grudgingly admit they have a guardian angel. Now, what that guardian angel is, whether you call it luck, whether you call it Zeus, whether you call it whatever, Summit was looking after that crew and looking after everyone on that aircraft.
True.
Whether it missed the top of the hill by 3 meters or 30,000 meters doesn't matter. It missed.
Yep,
definitely.
Altitude doesn't matter. It's when you go below that the problems start.
Yeah. No.
They managed to get everything right. Luck was on their side. They got it round and they landed.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
And that's, you know, there's 420 people still here through that set of circumstances working out right.
Yeah, no. Look, speaking of luck, I did read another article on the same thing, and they reckon the headwind increased slightly, which gave them a little bit of elevation, which managed to get them over that hill and turn left and dump fuel.
It's a small amount.
Just a bit of gust of wind.
It's a small amount, but they all add up. Yeah.
Yeah, it'll, definitely.
Yeah, a gust of wind that day at the right time gave them enough.
Yeah.
It's little tiny things that all stack up where if it goes wrong, whoops, where it goes right, you're good.
Definitely.
And this was occasion where they were good.
Yeah. So I think a big shout out goes to the crew for being so relaxed and calm on board when they knew they were going to die, because the passengers were none the wiser. They were actually taking photos. They thought we were going on a scenic view here. They didn't know what was going on.
Yeah.
So if there's anyone out there, Tom, what do you reckon?
I think if someone was on that flight.
Yeah, reach out
to us. Wuzotalk@outlook.com is the email. Send us your photos.
We want to hear your story.
I don't know this for sure, but again, from other people I've spoken to and been in contact with, there is inevitability acceptance. You see the circumstances and you think, that's it. I'm gone. And it almost gives you a calmness. They get overcome by a calmness. There's nothing I can do. I've got to accept it. And you deal with it from that calm acceptance point of view, which allows people to be heroes or heroines.
Good point.
And you can be a hero or a heroine by just coping, by not panicking. And that crew didn't panic. What that does reflects the training.
It speaks to that sort of reputation that Olympic Airways crew, you know, including the cabin crew, as well as the flight crew have. In Greece, you ask anyone and they would say to you, even today, that Olympic Airways had some of the best pilots in the world. I don't think that's an overstatement or an overreach. And as I said earlier, it was a requirement that they were military trained. They were in the Air Force. They were good aviators at the end of the day. And it still today is a source of pride.
Definitely. Well said.
It all comes down to their training. If you've got a military background, you are trained from the discipline point of view. There is a strong discipline concept in the training. I don't like separating out flight deck crew from cabin crew. As far as I'm concerned, they're all air crew and that's it. Mm. You look at the training that the OA people had. I'm not going to say it was the best because there are other airlines that are equally good, but it was equally good. You can put any Olympic crew up against the best in the world and they can hold their head up high. It's as simple as that. And that's not false pride. That's just looking at it from a historical point of view and how the crew dealt with things, not just this 7-4 incident, but a whole bunch of other things as well. They're damn good crew.
Great endorsement there. There's one last part to this story. I mean, there's multiple parts to this story, but after this period that we've been talking about now, obviously comes the era of government ownership. Obviously, you mentioned yourself, Graham, that the death of Alexandros basically was in large part of the catalyst for Aristotle selling the airline to the government, begrudgingly, I understand. It sort of started a decline, really, for the airline up until the 2000s, didn't it?
Yeah. It wasn't just the government. It was the politics of the trade unions as well. You can blame the government, or successive governments. You can, but equally, you've got to blame the trade unions. You've also got to blame other people that loved meddling in it, the people that were getting freebie flights or heavily discounted flights. No airline could survive the abuse of the commercial model that Olympic was subjected to, whether we're talking about media demanding flights and getting it because it was politically advisable to suck up to the media, to use the phrase, or whether it was the trade unions demanding excessive pay rises to keep the industry going and all this. I don't want to get involved in the politics of it all, but it was a whole mishmash of things. And then you had survival plan after survival plan after survival plan, none of which worked because the politicians were changing, the trade unions were changing because the membership election. And one survival plan had come out, something had happened, you'd have a whole new bunch of people in, and then it had to start all over again. No commercial concern can survive that sort of abuse, frankly. That's what briefly caused the terminal decline of the airline. They put in a management team from British Airways for a while there at one stage, which, you know, yes, right, fine. Let's gloss over that one. But it went with the eventual collapse. Could it have survived? That's a question that I get asked quite a lot, and it's probably one that's on your list as to whether the airline, under a different set of circumstances, could have survived. And I've got to say, I don't think it could have, because when you look at what the industry in general was doing, most of the major flag carriers didn't survive. British Airways evolved and evolved and evolved and is now part of one of the alliances. Swiss Air's gone. There's a whole bunch of other airlines gone. There's a predominance of low-cost carriers, whether you're talking about EasyJet, Ryanair or whatever out in Europe, JetBlue and whatever out in the US, Virgin down your way, and Jetstar. You've got all of these airlines that are operating on a super low-cost model, marketed on a super low-cost model, and frankly, they're conning the public. They're not as super low cost as they think. But the public want to fly for as cheap as they possibly can. We looked at this Kalymnos flight, and it's a very, very, very good demonstration of this. Sorry, I'm using English pounds as the costing, but there you go.
Okay.
We looked at a package deal out to Kalymnos from the UK, and it cost X. We have a tradition here. She who must be obeyed decides one year where we're going to go. Next year, I decide where to go. And the only rule we have is that whoever decides where to go does the booking. She found a place on Kalymnos. Nice little villa, complex, great stuff. And it was a flight from the UK on Olympic holidays. It was an Olympic holiday company, as it was called. And it was into EOS. Transfer from EOS Airport to EOS Town, across the water to Kalymnos Town, and a bus from Kalymnos Town to this lovely little villa complex called Norma's Village. And I looked at it all, and I was just about to book it, and there's this little tick box online. And I nearly went like that, and then I realised what it said. Transfers not included. I started doing some groundwork and I started doing some inquiries, including calling Norma's Village, because the principalities have all the hotel addresses listed online. So I goes to call up this Norma's Village, expecting to practice my extremely terrible Greek, to make inquiries. I called her, and what did I get? G'day. Norma was an Australian lady. I said, look, what's the transfer fee? Ah, she says, if you're a walk-on passenger, it's €2. I thought, well, I like this idea. When I started looking at the transfer on the website, it was €135 per passenger. Net result, a lot of groundwork done. I ended up with an Aegean Olympic Air flight out of London Heathrow into Athens, 3 hours on the ground at Venizelos, staying at the McDonald's Hilton, which seasoned travellers knows the reason for using the McDonald's Hilton. Got a quiet rest area you can kip in. And a flight out to Kalymnos, I saved myself using a scheduled airline service, that's Aegean and Olympic Air, €500 compared to going on the cheapo low-cost carriers. Low-cost carriers are not all they're accepted to be.
Wow.
But I don't think the original OA service would have survived the low-cost carrier model that so many of them use today. It just wouldn't have done it. The business model wasn't right. And the Greeks like a good deal, or an apparent good deal, the same as everybody else does. If you can fly EasyJet from London to Athens for apparently £9 for a single service, you're going to take it. The fact that they're going to charge you £300 coming back is neither here nor there. You see the cheap model and you go for it. I tell you one thing, £500 buys you a lot of fixes.
Sure it does.
Absolutely. The reputation of the airline during that period sort of suffered. Again, we're talking about maybe the 90s, the 2000s leading into this sort of debt crisis. The airline was bailed out. It had something like €2 billion, I think, in debt erased completely to sort of give them a fresh start.
Yeah.
And in amongst all of that, the reputation...
And then the EU complained about it.
Yes. And in amongst all that, as you mentioned earlier, there was a lot of union action and strikes became almost synonymous with the airline. Talk to us a little bit about that.
That was almost as good as the Brits at striking.
Was it just as bad there?
Yeah. At one stage, we had it worse than anybody. Our trade unions were experts at striking.
Mm. I mean, it was a bit of a running joke in our family. You know, we'd be going to Greece and we'd be making plans, and my mum would be the first one to say something like, well, that's all assuming that they're not on strike. It was such a common occurrence at this point, whether it was Olympic striking or air traffic control striking or something related to that.
Yes, don't forget air traffic.
Absolutely. I mean, this is something that sort of went hand in hand during that period and did quite a lot of damage, not just to the airline, but also to Greek tourism, didn't it?
Yeah, but that was a European thing. It was specific in the sense that it had a tremendous effect on the airline, but equally it was so bad pan-European, it affected everybody. I mean, there was one stage in particular where French air traffic control regularly went on strike. And they'd always choose to go on strike at the peak travel time, July and August, when everybody wanted to go on holiday. That would not just affect Olympic, although it did have a huge effect on Olympic, because if you think about the geographic location where France is, and you think about where the air routes are, not only to the UK, but also to the USA, they all tend to go through France, or coming back go through France. I mean, what could they do? They could either not fly or turn right at the French border, hang a right and do a big U-turn over Belgium, missing France. Well, that puts distance on and it causes air traffic control problems. It affects OA, or it affected OA, but it also affected all the other airlines that crossed that airspace.
Mm.
Then you had the local domestic strikes, whether it's strikes at Alinicon, whether it is maintenance strikes, whether it's Olympic catering, whether it's Olympic cargo, it doesn't matter which, it all has an effect.
Mm.
And no news is like bad news. So the moment you had an OA strike, the news spanned the Far East down to Australia in about a nanosecond, which is why your mum was sort of saying what she said.
Well, it makes me feel a lot better that it wasn't just our problem.
It was your problem because it affected you. That's why you see and saw it as your problem.
Mm.
But it was everybody's problem at the time.
Because most Greeks around the world would say that was just Olympic.
Of course they do. You know? Yes, good because of Olympic pride, because of Hellenic pride, because of Hellenic focus.
Mm.
I'm not being nasty. They see it like that. They see it blinkered because that's how it is. They're not affected by how things are in America unless it's affecting them directly. True. They're not affected by things in Germany unless it affects them directly.
True.
This is where this focus thing comes in. But it also comes in how the airlines of the 70s, 80s and 90s are totally different in corporate mindset than they are today. Today, if we've got a problem, the first thing we do, to hell with it affecting the passengers, cancel the aircraft, keep the aircraft where it is. We need it for catching up on the planned next stage. Back then, if there was a problem, there may have been a strike because the ground engineers are on strike, or the baggage, let's say the baggage handlers are on strike. That's a problem. I've seen flight deck crew load baggage for the passengers because the baggage handlers are on strike. It may be important to strike for more money, but it's more important to give the passengers the service they deserve. That doesn't happen nowadays.
Yeah.
Did a fragile tag mean anything back then in those days? My understanding was if it was a fragile tag, you'd throw it underarm instead of overarm.
Let's put it this way. At Heathrow, they were known as baggage smashers, not baggage handlers.
Nice.
At one stage, Heathrow wasn't called Heathrow. It was called Thief Row.
Classic.
How do you feel about the current state of affairs with Aegean taking sort of the lead and Olympic Air now, which is a different entity but same branding and is somewhat the successor to that story, being that sort of regional arm of the Aegean group?
A lot of older Greeks I know look somewhat disparagingly down at Aegean and look somewhat disparagingly down at Olympic Air. I regularly fly Aegean. I regularly fly Olympic Air. They operate a damn good service. Aegean operate a damn good service, like so many of the airlines now that are toe-to-toe against a low-cost airline. They're operating a modern fleet of aircraft, well-maintained, well-serviced, well-presented, well-turned out. The flight crew, equally well-turned out, well-presented. The flight attendants in the cabin are well presented, beautifully well presented. There's not a hair out of place. They look good. Where it's not so good, the cabin service. The food is not like it used to be. The presentation of the menus is not like it used to be. I'm not saying it's sunk to the level of the days of Court Line seat back catering, where you had a flap on the seat in front of you that you pulled your cardboard box out and that was your meal. But it's getting that way. You get offered half a cup of coffee. You get a small glass of Coke. The food, while edible, is not super attractive. But you pays your money and you takes your choice. Olympic Air domestically, well turned out aircraft, the flights are on time, you can't fault anything like that. Because it's a domestic service, you get a soft drink and a pack of biscuits. Okay, it does the job, it does what it says on the tin, you know, you can't complain about it, but the mystique isn't there. And that's the sad thing about it. It's missing the mystique of the Anassis years. They are doing a very, very good job in the face of very severe competition. Not a problem with that at all. But there's just something of the mystique missing.
It's a sign of the times, I think, more than anything. A sign of how the industry is moving along. And I mean, we've seen, you know, Aegean win. How many Skytrax awards have they won? The regional airline of the year now in a row. Something like 14 years in a row or something ridiculous like that. Yeah, I think you're quite right. They are doing a fantastic job. Having been in the industry as well, I think all of us would say that every airline's got a lot of work to do in terms of service. You know, when it comes to some people, it's the food. With other people, it's the service. With other people, it's just a smile at check-in. We could go on forever about it, about our gripes of air travel, couldn't we?
Yeah, it was nice to hear you say at the time where Olympic, from what we thought was the only airline that there was heading, you know, the opposite direction, but it was the Brits as well with the union strikes, and it was most of the airlines in that time frame were similar, because we're so invested in the Greek Olympic airlines, you think, oh, no, it's our airline that isn't up to scratch. But then they all were in a similar fashion, like you just described.
I think you're beating yourself up unnecessarily by thinking it was just OA. It wasn't. The truth of the matter is, in many respects, OA did a remarkable job against quite severe adversity. And that's something that people really should be proud of. They did a good job.
Well, it is an absolute icon of the Greek diaspora and of Greeks. People are still proud of it. Wherever they see it, there's merchandise even, you know. There's a coffee shop up the road here where there's an Olympic Airways towel hanging in the window, believe it or not, Graham. But
yeah,
the brand is still there and people still associate with it and people are still proud of it.
And so they should be. And so they should be. I just got a whole set of memorabilia here that I've collected over the years that one of these days, there's a group out in Greece that are doing their best to preserve the OA memory. And all of my archive material is going to go there because it deserves to be kept.
Fantastic. Nice. Well, Graham, thank you so much for being with us. It's been an absolute honor to have you here. Thank you for writing the book, one of the only real official sources on the subject matter. We're so glad that you took the time to actually do it. Where can people actually buy your book?
It's available from a UK publishing company called Pen and Sword up in Barnsley. That's what it looks like.
Fantastic.
Yes, we've got Onassis on the cover. Go online, look up Pen and Sword, look up Olympic Airways History, and take it from there.
Thank you so much for being here. And Nick, what are your thoughts, mate? Final thought from you.
Look, I love your stories, Graham. When you got into some of those stories, it was fantastic. And look, it was very refreshing to hear your view on Olympic Airlines and, you know, stamp out some of those theories that we had or some of those anomalies that we couldn't get to the bottom of. But look, it was fantastic having you here. Hopefully, we'll get a hold of that book and we'll get some more interesting reading.
I've had some good response, probably the nicest. A letter from the Hellenic Parliament. From the president.
Oh, wow.
Dear Mr. Simons, I was glad to receive your book entitled Olympic Airways, A History, which captures the journey of the largest Greek civil aviation airline and expounds on its progression throughout the years. The detailed account of this monumental company is a remarkable initiative, and I am sure it has attracted the interest of all those wishing to know more about the history of aviation from the most reliable sources of information. Hereby, I wish to express to you my warmest regards for sending me your book. You are considered an authority on the history of Olympic Airways. I hope that you will continue work with the same fervour. Sincerely yours, Konstantin Thasoulos, nice. President of the Hellenic Parliament.
Beautiful.
Kind of nice for an old boy from England, isn't it?
Congratulations.
You've done very well for yourself, Graham. And as I said, we couldn't be prouder of the fact that you took the time to do it. As it says there, it is such an important part of the Greek story and the Greek diaspora story, and you've played a huge role in helping us bring light to it. I just hope that people who listen to this podcast get a flavor of it and go and buy the book and learn even more about it. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for the chance of allowing me to speak to you guys. Most fun.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Graham.
And look, uzotalk@outlook.com is the email. Make sure you're sending us your emails. You know, if you've got a story about Olympic Airways, whether you've flown with them or had an experience with them, everyone's got a story. Good, bad, indifferent, whatever it is, they're all interesting. Let us know about them. And make sure you're following us on social media, @uzotalk and @uzo_talk on Instagram. Nick Athanasiou, this flight's come to an end, mate.
Tom, we've just landed, mate. The aerobridge has just touched. We hit the door. Door's opening. It's time to go, mate.
Good stuff. All right, we'll see you guys next time.
Ακολουθήστε μας στο Soundees, στο Spotify, στο Apple Podcasts και στο Google Podcasts.